Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, and welcome to the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Carla Long, and today I'm meeting with Matt Frizzell. Matt, I've known Matt for a long, long time, even though he used to get me confused with my sister, Kara, which is normal because Kara and I look a lot alike, and he went to Graceland with my sister rather than me, but we've known each other for a really long time. Sorry, Matt, I shouldn't have brought that up.
No, it's okay. I hear it every time. It's exciting.
Well, actually, it's a long story, but they accidentally gave one of my grades at Graceland to my sister, Kara, so I almost didn't graduate because she took Nature of Science twice, supposedly. That didn't happen. This is a very boring story. Let's move on.
Fair enough.
Okay. So Matt's going to talk to us a little bit about some stuff that I think that we all know about, some stuff that happens on social media, some critical thinking skills, things that it might be good to bring back to the forefront of our minds. So before we get started with all that, Matt, could you please tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, thanks. This is fun. I've been in Community of Christ my whole life. I've been a minister most of my professional life. Early on, I felt this deep desire to answer some of the questions that I had about life and about God, about religion. And they were existential questions for me, right? They were kind of like defining about my whole orientation to the fact that I had a life and shared it with other people. They were really important to me. So anyway, I felt led by God to take advantage of opportunities that came along the way. I often didn't see them until they came along the way. And I ended up going to seminary for quite a while. And anyway, it was really helpful because it was in seminary that I found people who were not only asking the questions, some of the questions that I had, but they were also doing it in a really critical environment where people were like, yeah, I have that question too, and I think your answer is horrible. That's crap. Why don't you think about it this way? And I was like, you really helped me break through something. I really appreciated that. I went to schools where critique and critical thinking and asking hard questions was one of the most important tools to insight and growth. And so I really appreciated that. I loved it. Matter of fact, I needed it in my life. And so anyway, seminary was great for that. And so ended up, you know, studying basically in Community of Christ, what we would call Zion, but it was the intersection of theology and social theory. How does our understanding of God and faith impact how we understand life together? But how also does life together impact how we understand theology? And what does that mean? I just want to give an illustration because I think this is really helpful real quick. Sometimes we, you know, we start from the one standpoint where we start with theology and we're like, the world should be this way, blah, 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 because God's story tells us this and we should be harmonious and get along and everybody's equal. That's how theology informs social life. Sometimes, though, you need to go the other way around. So when theology does things like, hey, isn't that great that men are superior to women? You're like, social theory tells you that's crap. And it also means that we can't live that way together. So we really need to use our understanding of real relationships to criticize our really bad beliefs. And so it always goes both ways. And that's a dialogue that is so rich and so alive. And what I find is that most people with any spirituality and religious background already have this conversation going on in their head all the time. We just don't name it. And so I found that just to be riveting. And so that's ended up being an area of study. And anyway, that's kind of what led me here. It was my background and time spent with that.
What a good introduction. And folks, that was just the introduction. We're going to dive deep into this. So Matt, I feel like I should make a confession to you. I am one of those people. I'm a conflict avoider if I can help it. I'm a harmonious person. You know, like I love it when everybody in the room is happy. And I want, one time we were doing like this personality kind of quiz. And while we were getting our results, the day we were going to get our results, this was in seminary actually, I had gone around to everybody in the classroom and I'd said, hi, everyone. Hi, nice to see you again. It's good to be here, blah, blah, blah. You know, making sure everybody in the room felt comfortable. And then the teacher said, Carla is such and such personality. And you can tell because she went around to every single person to make sure they were happy. So I hate conflict. I hate it. But that's a problem, right? For if we are going to be the peace and justice church that God calls us to be, we cannot have a church of Carlas that avoid conflict. We need to have that conflict because it's healthy, right?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, it's one of those things that I think today is really challenging because there's a lot of power struggles happening in the world, particularly if you live in the Western world, and in particular, if you live in the U.S. context. Right now, conflict has actually become a product that we buy and sell. Everything from talk shows to championship wrestling to even the dramas that we used to watch when I was a kid on soap operas. Does anybody remember soap operas? General Hospital.
You're still on.
As the World Turns. I mean, we conflict is a product. It's something we actually buy and sell, and that it means it's something we consume. And so we're happy doing that as long as we are in a place where it's safe to do so. When you're actually in a conflict and when you're actually engaging in the power struggle, it is very threatening. And one of the things that I really appreciated about social theory and learning about sociology was that you know, how we handle conflict is very much conditioned by several factors, one of which is where we are in the social organization. And so, and to use some grossly overturned generalizations, but people will know exactly what I mean when I say it. Middle-class people generally live in this space where their livelihood is based on their ability to make harmony. They are constantly navigating powers that they can't control in the power class above them, and organizing and managing things like labor and staff and others who often live in the world of poverty and chaos and difficulty, who are much more vulnerable and live in conflict all the time. And we make things work in this middle class, middle management, middle place by using the tools of organization and thinking and management to just constantly engage forms of conflict. And many of us make it or break it based on our ability to do that. It's an unconscious middle class fear to cause a conflict that is so bad that you either silently or overtly get rejected and banished, because none of us want that shame. And frankly, it can impact our livelihood. And it happens in churches. It happens in families. It happens in the workforce. It happens everywhere. I sometimes sit around in church meetings where we're all supposed to love each other, but I can feel this oppressive feeling that's like nobody wants to say anything that's going to cause too much of a conflict, because it is very emotionally disturbing. And it's not only emotionally disturbing, it can be threatening. So I don't want to make it just an emotional thing. It can actually threaten the relationships that sustain us. And so you come by it righteously, Carla. You're not alone.
Well, that's kind of good and bad to hear. I was hoping that everybody else was better at it than I was. Then I wouldn't have to be good at it because they're good at it, right? So what are the pitfalls of withdrawing from these conflicts, of not engaging in these conflicts at all? Is conflict always bad? How can conflict be positive? You know, things like that.
Sure. Well, and I think that's a fascinating discussion that brings us to the edge of our comfort zone, especially when you think about how social media is a very structured environment to control conflict and control our engagement in conflict.
Social media.
Well, I think that's where a lot of people today actually experience conflict. But I mean, we could also talk about how family is a very interesting place where conflict happens and doesn't happen. That's a whole nother conversation, but I'm thinking about social media just because that seems to be a place people experience a lot of conflict. And one of the reasons why that is because we cannot control the conflicts that we're in on social media. At least I should restate that. We can't control the conflicts we engage, but we can control when and how we engage them. And that's really key. We can just shut it off and don't have to. We can walk away and nobody even knows whether we have. We can block people. We can stop following somebody. We can unfriend. And one of the reasons why I think a lot of conflict happens on social media is because it helps us maintain a high level of control. I mean, for those of us who do get involved in conflicts on social media, we probably have somebody in our lives going, "You should just let that go. Stop talking and stop engage. Why are you talking about racism and politics again on social media?" Well, it's like, I do it because I'm deeply committed to dialogue. And I actually have no idea how democracy or community can work if we don't engage each other. And so, and I'm afraid of losing both community and democracy. And if I'm really afraid of that, I have to risk conflict. I have to risk being in dialogue with other people over controversial issues, over issues that in many ways the conflicts are constructed and by very powerful public media and news outlets and PR firms that help shape these political messages that really draw us in.
Something that is so, so huge that is just so oversimplified into a tiny meme that is like its only job is to make you mad. Its only job is to engage you in a way that you might not normally engage. Because you know in your brain, these are complex issues. These are huge issues. They cannot be summed up in a pithy little, tiny little statement. And yet, people know exactly how to, or companies, corporations, I don't know exactly how to get you emotionally involved.
Absolutely. And that engagement is part of the product that they sell, but it's also a huge propaganda industry. And I want to say something a minute. I'm not talking about conspiracy theory. I'm talking about things that anybody can go study. And if you want to spend the money or even just have the scholarships to go to university and read about these things in a critical, thoughtful way with standards for truth and standards for falsehood, you can do this. So I am not talking about, you know, some sort of, it's not that the empire is out there floating in the stratosphere, you know, beaming messages to control us. It's actually much more complicated than that. There's very real interests, which is what our democracy was based on. There's very real interests that are converging and conflicting over desired outcomes in our world. You know, who has freedom and who doesn't, and who gets benefit of taxes and who doesn't, and who gets these contracts and who don't, and you know, how much do we put into defense and how much do we put into social services? All of those are very real issues, and they're all deeply entwined in our economy. And so there's very real interests at work. So oftentimes what people put conspiracy theories on are really a way of just kind of simplifying what is a very complex interaction of interests, which is exactly what we designed our system to be. They've just become very powerful, and many of us feel very powerless and not able to do a lot about it. And so it's easier to kind of conjure up some explanations. And the funny thing is I think what makes them attractive is there's always a little bit of truth in them and also a whole lot of falsehood. They're just truthful enough to kind of draw us in. So that makes conflict, again, even harder.
Because I think what you just said, go ahead, finish up.
No, I was just saying it makes conflict harder because so you really don't know what you're engaging. It might be a big conspiracy theory, or it might be a very real discussion about how, let's say, racism and sexism is very real. And it does affect people's lives. And the people that it impacts, nobody reports on because they're nameless or they're poor or they're on the margins in some way. Yeah. And that's not a conspiracy theory. That, again, is a convergence of interests.
I think what you just said a little while ago about feeling powerless is, for me, it's probably the heart of how I feel on social media. These huge issues of racism and sexism and other isms that are so destructive. And I just don't even know what steps I could even take to help that. And so I don't engage necessarily in those conflicts because I just don't know what good that they do. So how can conflicts be positive, and not just on social media, like other places too? How can conflicts be positive? How can they be destructive? So what is the difference between those two?
Well, that's an excellent question. It's also obviously really, really complicated, and it depends to some degree on the person. I don't want to ever forget those very highly personal circumstances to consider where, you know, if I have a history of abuse, my tolerance for talking about sexism or violence issues is going to be different than somebody like me who's had the privilege of, I'm 6 foot one, I'm over 200 pounds. And I'm a white male. I have all sorts of privileges. I don't experience a lot of threats very often. And so my tolerance to engage conflicts is very different. And I want to be very, very sensitive to that. And so how can it be positive and negative? To some degree, we have to start with ourselves. What's healthy for us? You know, what can we engage and grow from and learn from? And to what extent do we need to pull back and heal? Seminary really brought that I had to deal with that in seminary because we dealt with a lot of privilege issues in seminary. And there were times when I felt like the conversations were destructive for me. I know now they weren't. They were incredibly enriching and they were incredibly helpful. I had to abide with those struggles. And I love the word abide because it just feels spiritual and religious to me. Abiding is a spiritual practice. It's dwelling with and living with. And that's one of the things that we do not want to live with in this world and dwell with, which is conflict. But by doing that in a structured environment, and that's really key, a structured environment, not a chaotic environment, where when the professor directed the discussion, we respected that. That really made the classroom a laboratory space for having discussions mm-hmm. that don't happen around coffee tables, that don't happen in coffee shops or at home around family dinner tables and such. And so that was really, really powerful. So one thing you have to think through what's healthy for me, and know too that sometimes if it hurts, it doesn't mean it's unhealthy, but sometimes it does. And having people on the outside of you who can help you guide through that, like, you know, just give you feedback from a third party perspective is really important. But the other thing that's important that I think in terms of healthy and negative conflict, in terms of when we're talking about peace and justice, is starting with our own tradition. The prophets engaged conflict. The prophets spoke politically. They lamented and critiqued leaders. Walter Brueggemann is actually very good about spelling out this relationship between the king and the prophets in the Old Testament, where the king was kept to this covenant to lead and to have power and to keep covenant in a certain way. The king in the Old Testament lived under another rule. They were not above the law, which is a real struggle today. We kind of feel like there's sovereign powers out there that can do whatever they want. That is not the model of kingship in the Old Testament. And the prophets often were the ones holding the king's feet to the fire. So when they made decisions that were, you know, threatening to the vulnerable, orphans, widows, foreigners, strangers, you know, go ahead and read it. Dig into the Old Testament. There is a lot of protest, a lot of conflict, a lot of indictment, and there is outright shaming. And this is where I think it becomes unpopular to talk about, but our scriptures, the prophetic voices outright shame the wealthy classes. They outright shame the kings for what they're doing. If we're going to include the Old Testament in our faith tradition, we have got to engage conflicts and we've got to engage the politics of power in a way that leads in the same direction that the prophets were trying to lead to, which is faithfulness to a kind of righteousness and justice under God that was understood by the people, was testified to in Torah. And we have to be willing to call people into account and be willing as privileged classes. And when I say we, remember, I'm always talking about Matt Frizzell, white male, some kind of Protestant straight person. You know, people who have education, even if we don't have money, but if we do have more money, it's always a matter of comparing to who, right? We have to be willing to be held account. So how do you have positive and negative conflicts there? That's the question I heard you ask, but I thought we really need to talk about why conflicts are spiritually have value and have precedent for us. Before I jump into the next piece of it, I just wondered, I was seeing you nod a little bit. I didn't want to know if you wanted to respond to that, because I usually when you talk about the prophets in the Old Testament and social justice, people's attitude about conflicts all of a sudden changed. Like, yeah, fight the power, speak truth to power. You know, we get really excited about seeing the world set right side up again. Otherwise, why wouldn't we? Why would we not watch The Hunger Games or Star Wars? I mean, we want to see the world set right up again, right?
You know, I was nodding along with you about the prophets and things like that, and it reminded me, this is an anecdote that I use every once in a while. When I was working in Europe, I had the chance to go to Karlstein Castle in the Czech Republic, and I found it very interesting because the king at the time, Charles, he sat in this chair with two windows onto his side, and he would look, the windows are right behind him. And he wanted that because he wanted to see the person's face talking to him, but he didn't want them to see his face. So when the sun is shining in your eyes, he's in shadow, so you can't see his face. And it made it extra scary to speak truth to power. So whatever that person couldn't, was more scared to say something to the king than otherwise. And so I think about that sometimes. When you mentioned that about speaking truth to power and getting after it, that's what immediately came to my mind, is how scary it is and how the powers that be make it more scary, actually. So I don't know if that's where you wanted to get into, but that's where my mind immediately went to Karlstein Castle in the Czech Republic.
Go ahead.
No, I'm done.
No, you go ahead. No, I'm not going to have a conflict with you, Carla. I refuse to.
Oh, we're getting into it. No, really, I'm all done.
Well, it's funny. You made me think of another podcast thing about masks, because not being able to see someone's face is actually a really, and the philosophical and theological power of seeing a face is actually a really interesting late modern and postmodern philosophical theme. But again, I kind of just jumped into an academic rabbit hole there. But it's something that is very relevant and important, this concept of masks and seeing a human face, because we do, in many ways, social media operates as a mask. You do not, nobody has to see your face, and everybody gets a mask, and the avatar is making your own mask. I mean, it's very interesting to think about how this works, because it's all about representation, confrontation, engagement, which ultimately is about relationships. And when we think of relationships, we often think about friends and family and people we love. The world is made up of relationships completely. That's one of the things sociology helps you see, is that everybody is intimately and inextricably wound into something else and some other people and some other histories and some other people's stuff. And those relationships are masks, is a key part. But you said something about positive and negative conflict and engaging those. And I guess that is something that I do think we need spiritual tools and kind of moral, ethical tools to navigate. And I think it'd be a challenge to try to talk about that. So in peace studies, we talk about two forms of peace. This is kind of an intro to peace studies concept. You know, we have positive peace and negative peace. These aren't feeling terms. So when I say negative, I don't mean like negative peace. You know, I'm not talking about
peace.
Yeah, I'm not talking about peace that feels bad. I mean it, and by the way, positive peace actually doesn't often feel good. The irony, I didn't realize this until right now. The irony about those two definitions is we actually usually feel the opposite about them. Yeah. Most of us prefer negative peace because it's based in security, and we don't like positive peace because it's based in vulnerability, conflict, and risk. And so I had never kind of thought about it that way before, but anyway, you're hearing me think out loud. So negative peace is the absence of conflict. You know, when it's in a good way, it's tranquility and serenity and the world at peace. Kind of when I walk at 5 o'clock in the morning and the sun is coming up, and I hear the birds tweet, and I'm still not hearing any cars move, and the water is still, and I can see the reflection of the canopy and the treetops in the water. That kind of tranquility and absence of all conflict, that stillness, is in many ways a good kind of negative peace, because there is no conflict. It's conflict-free. And there's just kind of a beauty and a peace there. I guess now I'm using the same word twice. But negative peace can also be created with threat. You know, if you do that again, this is what's going to happen. And so, and this is often what people in peace studies will talk about happens is the peace of empire. You know, peace, we can create negative peace by just having extraordinary law enforcement, a lot of money in military and violence, a lot of ways to suppress conflict. When you suppress conflict, you create a negative peace, a kind of peace that is forced, but it's also a kind of security. Do you hear how ambivalent it is? I'm trying to talk about it in like positive and negative terms to get us to think, because there are forms of negative peace that are really important when we really are talking about security and suppressing conflict so certain things can happen.
What I hear you say, though, is that negative peace is really only peace for those in power. It's not peace for those that have been suppressed, people who have been oppressed. Is that true?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If the absence of conflict benefits the unjust order, then yes, that is a negative peace that is it's positive in the sense that it's good and a benefit for some, but it's based on repressing conflict or holding power over others. And you know, we even do this in our homes when you're a parent. You know, we often want negative peace. Yeah, mom. Carla's a mom. She knows negative peace.
You go to timeout right now. You're in timeout.
Oh yeah, I grew up with it, and I reinflicted it to my own children. I mean, there's by the way, it's part of surviving. So it's really good that we're unpacking negative peace, because its pivot is the absence of conflict. So you can do that in ways that encourage flourishing and encourage justice, but you can also do it in ways that suppress it and hurt and cause a very, it's a truly negative form of peace, because things look fine, but underneath the surface, there's injustice and problems. Well, then there's positive peace. And positive peace is usually based on a sense of conflict and thriving. So positive peace happens because there's engagement and there's a form of justice and reconciliation and change taking place that is bringing peace that is dynamic and it accommodates conflict. So when you ask, you know, when is there good and bad conflict, I have to talk about it in terms of positive and negative peace. There's a kind of negative conflict that just reinforces negative peace. It's a kind of conflict that doesn't lead to thriving in a positive form of peace. And there's conflicts that do lead to positive forms of peace that we usually talk about as Zion or the kingdom of God, or when we see a movie and there's a thriving city and people are bickering, but it's not a bad thing. And they're all just kind of working out their space and enjoying their freedom. Positive peace is a free space that's conflict positive, where all conflicts reach towards justice and right relationships. And that is a form of peace that requires conflict. So how do we know, you know, how do we navigate conflict in terms of how we navigate positive and negative peace? I think that's the next question that's important to answer in terms of conflict.
Do you want to go ahead and answer it?
Well, I wanted to give you a chance to give me your perspective, because I mean, does that make sense to you?
It does, actually. And it made me think about actually what something that could have been a conflict on Facebook. I really don't get into conflicts on Facebook. I use Facebook more of like, oh, look at my cute kid kind of thing. But
or dinner. Here's a picture of dinner.
What's important in my life? Kids and dinner, right?
And kittens and puppies.
And so it was something about a political issue. And one of my acquaintances, I don't know if she's a friend, but one of my acquaintances said something that I just completely disagreed with. but I was surprised by it. So I already had typed out like, what are you thinking? That's ridiculous, blah, blah, blah. I deleted it and said, can you tell me more about what you're thinking? And it completely changed the conversation. And I walked away from that instead of feeling super mad. I walked away from it thinking, well, that's a different way to look at it. Something I wouldn't have done if I would have typed in something while I was really angry. And I mean, this is a very simple, obviously everybody has done this, but just the difference in the conflict of when somebody is more open to listen and somebody's more open to, or when both parties are more open to listen, I guess. So, I mean, it completely changed the conversation. And I walked away feeling 1,000% better. And I think she did too. So, I mean, just little things like that. That's all. That's all I want to say.
Well, that's a big thing because you helped us really see how our approach to positive and negative peace starts with our approach to positive and negative conflict inside of us. That decision is usually made emotionally. And it's usually, that's one of the things I'm so grateful about neuroscience in the last 50 years. We really do have greater tools to understand conflict and peace than we've had before because neuroscience knows more about how we handle conflict and the different biological pieces of that, the neurological pieces that feed conflicts that turn into life and death struggles and conflicts that actually lead to new insights, asking questions, Carla Long, like you did, and trying to bring conflict into an open space where rational processes, and when I say rational, I don't mean Spock and Vulcan. I just mean you stop and make deliberate decisions. And right and wrong is not about winning and losing. Right and wrong is about collaboration and a mutual understanding. That approach to conflict is very, very difficult. And the reason why I think we see such failure at it in social media and even in the world today, because our sense of conflict, I think, has heightened a lot in my lifetime. I'm a Gen Xer, you know, that since the 1970s and 80s, there's just been kind of a frothing of conflict politically and the culture wars and all this stuff we could trace out. Our political leaders, our presidents, senates, and our senators and Congress folks, their comments are more visceral than they've ever been before. I mean, there's a lot less restraint, a lot less mutual respect, and it's more like, I'm going to win this. So conflict itself has changed in the public square.
It's a and gotcha.
And so those decisions. Oh, absolutely. Which just turns on the heat. So we all become more defensive. And I think we both know what happens when two people have their fear centers triggered and all those hormones that pour into either fight, flight, or freeze, you know, those parts of our brain that are very, very biologically simple and they're a part of surviving and they're a part of being human and we all have them. You know, nobody's exempt. Nobody has evolved to the point where they do not fight, flight, or freeze. You know, it's part of being who you are. Jesus had to face that. So anyway, those parts of our brain are parts that are triggered regularly in this environment that we're in. And when you don't feel safe, it's very, very difficult to have any sort of positive conflict. It's very, very powerful, very, very difficult. And I think that's where we are in our public, and even in a lot of our churches and in social life.
And that goes back to what you kind of started this podcast out by saying is that, you know, I didn't grow up with a lot of fear in my life, you know, like I grew up with a lot of privilege too. So you don't know what people are dealing with already when you step into a conflict with them. You don't know what they're going to be bringing to the table if they're already bringing a lot of baggage with them. So I guess that's another thing to think about. Like, people like you and I who had happy, easy childhood, who were encouraged to go to school, who are cisgendered, you know, things like that. We just don't know. We just don't know. So I'm just taking you back to your very first point right now.
Well, yeah, exactly. We each one of us are different and should respect our different tolerances for conflict. Because like I said, conflict is we're talking about, conflict is very powerful. Conflict has to do with power, essentially. Again, sociologists are so helpful to just naming something we all feel. Conflict has everything to do with power. And one of the ways to approach conflict when it, because of power, is to dominate. And that's the fight part of our response. That's also part of Darwinian, you know, survival of the fittest. One of the ways to be fit is to win every fight. And of course, don't get me wrong, Darwin's theory is very complicated. There are also master chameleons and people who you can also run the fastest and you don't win, but you survive. So, I mean, survival of the fittest isn't always about winning, but that is one of the ways survival of the fittest works, is that biologically we get into a fight and that's how we stay safe, as we dominate. And by the way, I think this is a very interesting time to talk about the politics around guns in America and even across the West. You know, there's this entire philosophy that's about, I feel safe by winning, and or having the biggest gun or having the most guns, or I will protect myself. That's part of our culture. And I'm not saying it's the only way to look at gun rights. I'm just saying I think it's part of the piece of it. When you see the obvious intersections of masculinity and violence and security and protectionism and fear, there's a powerful concoction there to look at how we win and deal with conflict. I'm going to deal with conflict by winning. And that's just one piece of it. But that's not very positive conflict, I wouldn't think. I mean, that's probably not the way to resolve real social justice issues, because of course we go back to our Old Testament models. You know, in the Old Testament models, the ones who are suffering from injustice, they're not well armed. They're widows. They're orphans. They're strangers. So that means they're on foot, and what they can carry either on foot or on their donkey is all they have. So I mean, those are the protected classes of the Old Testament and of the dreams of Zion. You know, those are the lambs that lay down with lions. And to care about that, we, you know, violence won't solve that. So there's got to be other ways to approach conflict. There's got to be other ways to win in conflict.
So I feel like we're moving into this part, this next question. And if we're not, please, you can change the conversation. But it seems like what is being called for is some critical thinking, is a way to say, okay, I'm not going to get emotionally involved with this. I'm going to step back. I'm going to think about how I feel about it. I'm going to think about how you feel about it and think about why this is evoking an emotional response in me. And then I can respond. Yeah? No?
No. Yeah. I think that's exactly it. So we're kind of meandering into, and by the way, this conversation I think needs to be meandering, because when to talk about conflict is to navigate how we feel about what we hear, but then how we critically reflect on it too. Because most of us can agree with conflict's bad. We don't need to think anymore about it. We don't like it. But when somebody says conflict's good, it's like, ooh. Yeah, I guess I realize that there has to be some level of conflict to move forward. But I don't like conflict. You know, you see, I really resonate with the philosophers who said, you know, pain and discomfort was the springboard of rational thought. Why am I suffering? Why does this hurt? What can I do about it? You know, that's a springboard for it. And so that also is an approach to understanding critical thinking. When we do experience pain, whether it's as rudimentary as being in a conflict and feeling like we're losing or feeling ashamed or feeling threatened, one response is to actually not think at all. It's to fight, flight, or freeze. You know, just kind of either fall into a pattern of freezing and hoping everything passes, because that's one way that you can deal with conflict, or you start running away from it, the avoidance. You said you're the avoider. You know, you probably are used to fleeing, or other people whose, you know, the hair on the back of their neck comes up and they come out to dominate. The alternative to that is to have enough presence of mind, and I'm not saying that's simple and easy to have, because again, neuroscience has told us when you feel threatened, it is very hard to think. It happens when you get frustrated with technology and you can't see the solution, and if you were just not triggered, you would be able to see it easily. You know, I'm saying technology because I had one of those, had to type in my password 4 times mornings. How stupid is it? Why should I have to type in my password four times. I know my password, but my frustration level and my hurriedness and my inability to stop and critically think is what caused me to not slow down and pay attention to each key click. So I did it four times. Incorrect. This metaphor happens in real life on Facebook. It happens in the middle of marital conflicts. It happens on the Congress floor. It happens in congregations. It happens in our families where we don't turn on our critical thinking yet. And we think we're being highly rational, but we're standing on top of emotions that are driving every thought we're having. And again, I really thank neuroscientists for that, to help us understand that when we feel threatened, it's very hard to critically think, but critical thinking is actually the way to transition to positive conflict and to positive peace. Because when there is difference, and there is even opposition and enmity, if there is enough security and ability to slow down and step back, those opportunities to reflect and to dialogue, to converse, seek insight, go below the surface, look at the structures that are making the conflicts what they are, that's actually how we have made progress over the last 500 years in the human world, that it has been a turn to rationality and critical thinking. And that form of critical thinking is the engine of positive peace. Matter of fact, I'm making an academic point. Part of the process of peace studies and one of the ways to approach it is to do critical thinking. Is gender biological? Are men and female wired that way? Our ability to critically think about gender in non-binary terms has absolutely opened up our ability to think about gender. And it all was driven, or I should say a large part of it was driven by critical thinking. We were willing to ask assumptions that we had held as truths that were not true. Whether race is real, whether gender is real, all sorts of assumptions. This actually does get back to religion too, because religion used to say some things that we thought were unquestionable. And part of the Enlightenment process was to question them. That's why Galileo, you know, really rocked the world, because there was just all sorts of assumptions that needed to be questioned and alternative methods. And one of those methods was critical thinking. So yes, critical thinking is key. Being critical is key. Stopping and saying, no, I disagree with that. Or no, maybe that's not true. Or no, I need to stop and see whether I agree with you. It stops all the processes that are emotionally driven and starts moving into an ability to look again, reflect, respect, to look again. That re is part about doing it again. And I think that's what's really key. And that was one of the things that I was taught in seminary, is that a critical process of critical thinking and asking questions, even about things that we thought were true, was key to positive peace and justice. It had to be, because oftentimes the negative peace held in by the authority of assumptions was truly oppressing people and erasing people and suffocating people, whether it's slavery or binary gender or class structures, anything about the world. If we can critically think about it, we can open up opportunities and possibilities.
Well, I feel like that's where that vulnerability piece comes in, because there are moments when, you know, like I'm sitting in a meeting and I have a question, but I don't want to ask the question because I don't want to look stupid, you know, and I don't want people to think that I don't know something that I should know. But it goes back to that critical thinking. You know, gender is something that we've all known forever. There's two genders and that's it. But As you said, somebody was vulnerable. Somebody asked the question. And now it's created a big conversation, a much bigger conversation. So that vulnerability piece, I think, is very, very important in this critical thinking. Because like there are times when I stay silent, even though I might want to say something or ask a question to try and burst things open. But I don't want to look dumb.
Well, none of us want to be ashamed. And I mean, that's a whole nother conversation. Thanks. Thank you for Brené Brown, who opens up a whole area of that for us, you know, to think about how shame works. But it, and Brené talks about this. There's also a really key social function to shame. You know, shaming is what keeps us in line. That's why we don't say anything. That's why we don't deviate. It's very, very, very powerful social control. And it's a form of negative peace. I won't disrupt the waters because I don't want to risk being shamed. And shaming is a very interesting thing. It's emotionally a basically a way of saying you have no place here. There's no seat for you. You shouldn't even be here. Life would be better if you were excised, you know, cut out, surgically removed. That's what shame is. Shame is that exact feeling when you walk into a room and there's no place for you to sit. And usually we feel like we can keep our place as long as we just don't disturb the peace. And so that's why shame is so powerful. And it's also, it was really an insight for me to realize my white privileged male middle classness is driven by that. Shame is I didn't grow up a world that was full of violence because shame did its work. You shamed yourself into conforming. You shamed yourself into acting like a true man or a true woman or, you know, succeeding because you didn't want to be a failure. That's shameful. All these things that are driven by shame. And you're right. This is not off topic. Conflict requires a risk of that. Because also the binary categories of right and wrong have to be opened up. And there is forms of critical thinking that open up right and wrong and that open up possibilities and open up new insights. And there's also a form of critical thinking that simply closes them all back down, just reinforces old prejudices, that reinforces old resentments, that reinforces old sufferings that are not open to any possibility of reconciliation or new movement, new insight. And that kind of criticism is just resentful. And it's what we call in the political realm, hate. When you're critical of something because you're blasting it to dominate it and to shame it and to eradicate it, that's why we call it hate. And it's a very, I often have found that this term that when we use it, you know, that people are like, they're full of hate or that's hate speech. The people who are giving it often are like, this isn't hate. I'm not trying to be hateful, but it is hate because it suffocates and it's intended to shut down possibility and to reinforce old prejudices. And that's why it's hateful. And it's usually based on a power dynamic. It's to reinforce a power dynamic, to keep a power structure in place. I'm better than you, or I deserve this and you don't, or I'm entitled to this and you're not. That is usually where all the hate speech, people go into negative conflicts to reinforce a negative piece because I benefited from the old negative piece. So when I say negative, the peace with P-E-A-C-E, you know, I liked the old order, so I'm going to back it up and I'm going to sustain it. And usually that's when we start spewing hate speech. But to us, it's just normal. It's like, yeah, no, of course, it's always been this way. This is the way it's supposed to work. But we call it hate speech because it's shaming and suffocating. I know what I just said is probably mind-bending for some people or even numbing because it's hard to get your head around that. But I've always been trying to... Your comment about shame is really key, and the way we talk about positive and negative conflict is key. It is possible to open up critical thinking to look at new possibilities and mutuality, but there's also ways to do it that is resentful and confirming of old biases and old prejudice. And hate speech or using hateful language is one of the ways to use conflict in a negative way like that.
Wow. What is the term when you think about your thinking, meta thinking or something like that? Like that, that is, I mean, that's just, there's a lot in there. There's a lot in there. We only have about 15 minutes left of the podcast. I wanted to get to this point because I really want you to be able to talk about it. And we've touched on it every once in a while, but how does all of this talk about conflict and negative peace and positive peace, how does it relate to real life faith situations in the world?
Yeah. So our conversation was pretty heady. Even at that point, I, I'm sitting here feeling my own shame and afraid I lost some people when I started taking all those steps, jumping to talking about negative conflict and hate speech. But I think the insight is really important because, again, in real life, we can use critical thinking, we can use disagreement, and we can use even questioning like you did in the conflict. You had an experience with someone on social media. You heard something that offended you or that just hit you sideways. And instead of coming out with fight or flight, you opened up a conversation by asking for more information. That's where this is all really, really important for understanding how things happen or how we deal with conflict in real life. And we've heard this before, right? If we can ask questions and open up dialogue, then we can have positive conflict, learn new insights, get to mutuality and deeper justice and ways to live better and do things better. But of course, not a lot of us approach conflict that way. A lot of, especially in the social sphere, it's all about winning. And so navigating and finding safe places for where we can, this is one of the things I wish the church could be. And I pray that it can be a place where we do open up safe places to have positive conflict. That's where I think this has everything to do with faith. Jesus is probably one of the most powerful examples of positive conflict for me. I know many people have inherited what we know now, and I guess I didn't know until I studied it, was a very 19th century view of Jesus, which was an ideal person who never got mad, who lived out Victorian morality, never deviated from, you know, what was right and perfect, and never got angry and never swore or, you know, and I'm trying to be colorful, but my point is that many of us have inherited a very ideal view of Jesus. But if you read Jesus's interactions with people in scripture and you do so with a sense of cultural context, Jesus is very, very spunky. Jesus calls people into account. He says very controversial things that you shouldn't say in the streets. He does offensive things like talks to people that he shouldn't be talking to and asks for water for women at a well who shouldn't be there. And he tells stories that actually most people in a podcast would turn off because they don't lead to preconceived conclusions. They're designed to make people think.
Well, yeah, I've wondered every once in a while, like if Jesus came, like, I'd be like, I do not want to be friends with that guy. Like, I've thought about that quite often. I'm like, I don't want to hang out with that guy. He's annoying.
He would be annoying because he'd call you into account. I know one of the things that I often, in my own scripture study, and I prepare for, you know, sermons or whatever, and I get led through the lectionary, and I get to read even more and more of Jesus, these Jesus stories. Jesus kind of has there is a principle that seems to run through it, and Jesus consistently holds people account to their own judgments. And that's one of the things that's really interesting to me. We usually think of authority and of judge, you know, who has the right to have authority and judgment? Well, you know, we think that that comes from God, so it's outside of us, and it's, you know, objective authority, like from the state or from our fathers or from the church authorities or something. In actuality, Jesus models a kind of much more, it's almost a Socrates type interaction where he's like, well, what do you think? You know, how would you judge this? And then whatever you answer, you have to hold that standard up to yourself. And Jesus is constantly making people, you know, it's like, look at that sinner. They're doing X, Y, and Z. And Jesus is like, well, I know what you did this morning. And, you know, puts it out on and, you know, whoever sins, throw the first stone. Whoever is not, you know, Jesus is constantly taking these do unto other principles and applying them back to people.
One thing I didn't know about Jesus was that Jesus had a Southern accent. That was that's new for me.
Jesus has every accent there ever was. Jesus is the universal human. Jesus didn't speak English, so I mean, that alone should tell us something. But anyway, Jesus ends up becoming a really powerful model for actually getting back to real life and understanding conflict. Jesus was constantly engaging people in conflictual arrangements, going to people's homes that he maybe normally wouldn't go to if he was a good rule-following Jew from Galilee. He's interacting with people in the streets. He's confronting people in Jerusalem. He's engaging lawyers who supposedly know the law better than him. He's a nobody. He's an uncredentialed nobody. And he is taking on people in authority and speaking truth to power by asking questions and engaging in conflicts. They may not be fights. There's a difference. Sometimes there are fights that he gets into, but they're certainly conflicts. And Jesus is our model for understanding that. And you'll notice on the cross, you probably have one of the most important indictments of winning as an approach to fighting that I've ever seen, because Jesus doesn't win. He doesn't. He ends up on the winning side, but he doesn't do it by winning. He overcomes, he doesn't dominate. And that is an incredible model for understanding how spiritually conflict is important and how to navigate through it. And I think you see this in models of nonviolence, nonviolent direct action, where you actually instigate conflicts for the sake of justice, but you do it not to win. And that is real. You do it to overcome, and you do it to expose, and you do it to kind of reveal the injustice that's there. This becomes a really, really important way to understand how positive peace comes about. And you did it when you just had this simple emotional reaction. You stopped and you critically thought and said, I want to know more about this before I respond to it. And by the way, that's not the only reason to ask questions. I know sometimes when I teach, I often ask people to explain more, not just because I'm interested in understanding better, though that's part of it. Sometimes people come to the contradictions and the falsehoods of their own positions if you just make them explain it. And you realize, oh, this is based on an absolute prejudice that I feel, but I didn't really make it into my mind yet, my critical consciousness yet. So, and that we did that in seminary quite a bit. There was a constant opportunity to dig deeper and to see the exposed structures of what we thought and felt. And that became really, really an important way.
I think one thing that you just brought out is really an important piece as well. When we look at our intentions, like what are we trying to get to? Are we trying to get to that place in power? Are we trying to get to that, I got you, I'm right? Then that is probably not the right way to go. You know, that's probably not the right thing to type. That's probably not the right thing to say. If all what our intentions are saying to us. So I kind of, we only have about 5 minutes left. I want to ask you, and this is what I'm moving into, like, what's some practical advice for people who want to engage critical thinking and dialogue as an approach to conflict rather than the other way? And I think that's one way, the intentional, you know, being intentional and thinking about your intentions is one way to do it.
Yeah, I think, well, the first thing people should do is begin to, if you haven't self-reflected or even written down what you feel like your own conflict tolerance is, it's really important to kind of just have a self-concept of that. You know, maybe you like conflict, and there's not many of those, but maybe you dislike conflict and you're a conflict avoider. Getting to know yourself, this whole journey towards critical self-consciousness is really, really, I think, essential. Excuse me. And I think it's very, very key to understanding how we work in conflict, because the fact is none of us hover above it. When we engage it as ourselves and all of our history, and, you know, whether it's family history, cultural history, social history, we just bring it with us. The other thing to do is to think about, is to spend some time, and none of this is quick. These are spiritual practices. You don't ever do them and move on. You do them and you keep them a part of your life. Where do you live in the social system? How much power do you have? Are you someone who's secure by winning, or are you somebody who's used to getting by complying and being by deferring power and avoiding conflict? Understanding how, that's another key to the first part. Understanding who you are in the social system helps you understand how you shape your own emotional reactions and disposition to conflict. The third thing I think that people need to do is find a community of accountability, but also of support, where you can talk about things that are conflictual and that matter. You know, some people don't have a marriage like Margo and I do, but Margo is a wonderful conversation partner for me because she is free to support me and she is free to disagree with me. And I often get both in the same sentence. And, and that's been a really key part of our glue. You know, we're willing to wrestle with life together, and whether it's with your partner, and sometimes you need your partner just to be your safe space. And so I'm not saying that should be the model. I'm just saying it's one of many models, but finding then friends or people in churches or communities accountability where you can not only be heard, but also be supported, and to develop those relationships where people can ask you critical questions about what you really mean, what you really think, is a very important spiritual practice for engaging conflicts to change the world. Because I have not, in my teaching about social justice and in my teaching about nonviolent movements and my teaching about how the world changes, Jesus is probably the only story that comes off as if he changed the world by himself. But we all know in reality he didn't. He was surrounded by 12 friends. He was surrounded by even another community of women and of followers and disciples. And he was in a part of a community. So establishing a kind of safe community where you can engage in conflict in a healthy way is really key. And then the last thing to do is to take risks, is to go out and engage in conversations with people where you can, but also being free to test your voice and disagree and engage in public dialogue with other people so we can work towards a positive piece where we ask questions and look for new opportunities. Part of that is something that people already have started doing. So what I'm about to say, most people have already done without the other steps. And that is learning when you're engaging somebody who wants to engage you and learning when you are engaging somebody who really just wants to shame you and really just wants to dominate you and really doesn't give a crap about what you're saying. In other words, you can't make somebody have a dialogue. It takes two. And if somebody is just continually shaming and shutting you down and in an us-them kind of threat, that's a kind of biology that you can't overcome until somebody's willing to willfully do it. And so becoming vulnerable with people who, in discerning where can I have productive discussions and where I can't, is key. I noticed you take a breath, Carl. I want to give you an opportunity to respond before I said my next thing.
Oh, no, I want you to keep going. My mind's just going. I want you to keep going.
Well, I just wanted to lift up even though this sounds like a duh kind of statement to me in my ears, it's actually something that's very strategic. And I'm really glad that the movie Selma kind of points this out in the life of Dr. Martin Luther King. If you read the civil rights movement as exactly what I just described, a very strategic engagement with conflict, you can see in many of the dialogues there that King and the civil rights movement were very tactical about who they engaged and why. They did not go to places to expose racism that in ways that was very veiled. So there's a story. One of the reasons why they engaged Bull Connor is because Bull Connor was such a ruthless racist that it brought the news out. It created the conflict and exposed the injustice of racism that was there. It broke the negative piece. And so he was very, 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 very conscious about how he engaged people. Now, don't get me wrong. That's not the model of conflict I'm saying people should take, but I'm saying the strategy is. Because when he went to the courts and when he went to certain Congress folk and worked for political change, that's where he was very targeted on who would work with him and who wasn't. So in the streets, he worked with people who were against him and who would expose the injustice of racism and its violence for the public. In other words, he engaged people who had no interest in dialoguing with him. And then when he went to where the power conversations are in the courts and in Congress, he was very strategic about who he spoke to. And that's actually That is essential for political activity, and it's essential for social strategy and social change. There is not, if you're interested in social change and you want to study it, there is not one example that I can think of where somebody doesn't use exactly that kind of strategic work to have the kind of positive and negative conflicts that they need to have to make the change that they're after. And it, the same thing happens in our personal lives. So engaging those people in our lives that will help us build community and build justice and a more equitable and peaceful world, that people who will lead, you have to find out who those positive peace people are. And you do also need to engage people who aren't necessarily on your side, but for different reasons, because there's things that you can learn from them. And there's also things that you need from them to expose. This is just going from the Dr. Martin Luther King example, who exposes the injustice of the negative peace that really isn't peace at all. So anyway, I think those are some practical ways that we can think about, use critical thinking as a tool to engage conflict in a positive way.
Wow.
And always remember, you need religion to get there. I mean, I like the civil rights movement for that. Every time there was a song that sang, every time there was prayer and worship, and every time there was a gathering, it was about pulling people together to support one another in suffering. And that was key too.
Oh, Matt, this is just so much information. This is a lot. Is this what goes on in your head on a regular basis, this kind of stuff?
When you teach classes on it, they have to be, man. This is Zion building.
That's true. And that's important stuff. Well, I just want to thank you so much for being willing.
No, it's not all the time. Sometimes I just have to make pancakes or lasagna or...
or work in your RV.
Try to fix the floor in a 50-year-old camper.
Well, I really appreciate what you had to share with us. It's, for me, it's been a really mind-opening. Because sometimes I yell at my husband, I yell at Kuzma for being too much of a critical thinker. And when I say critical thinker, I mean he's being really critical. And so maybe I need to reshape how I talk to him about that kind of stuff. So I think you just helped my marriage.
Well, good. That's exciting.
Well, at least Kuzma will thank you.
Well, awesome. Thank you, Kuzma. Yeah, because he's helping us with this podcast.
But
there's a dialogue between head and heart that we didn't really talk about, but I think is really important here too. And often that's what happens.
Well, I appreciate you very much. Thank you so much. And I'm sure we'll be hearing from you again.
Blessings.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.